Welcome to Jom Talk Pets Season 2 by Royal Canin, where health is backed by science. We are going to address a wide array of topics covering the health and well-being of every cat and dog. I'm Davina Goh, hosting this session, and together with me, I have key science experts in the industry sharing their opinions. In this episode, we're going to explore the similarities of separation anxiety between animals and humans, the root cause of separation anxiety, the remedies to relieve the stress caused by separation anxiety, as well as treatments that would be able to heal anxiety-related trauma for humans and animals alike. So joining me to share their insights, two special guests. Our first is a man who wears many hats, from being the clinical psychologist and director at the Mind Psychological Services and Training, and an EXCO member of the Malaysian Society of Clinical Psychology. He is also a sessional lecturer in Monash University, Malaysia, in the Masters of Professional Counseling program, and he moonlights as a regular featured guest speaker on Light FM's Breakfast Show. Please help me welcome Dr. Joel Lowe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Our second guest has an MSc in International Animal Welfare, Ethics and Law from the University of Edinburgh. She has over 17 years of experience in international animal welfare, particularly in companion animal welfare projects, animal sheltering, and veterinary education. She has just obtained a membership in the Animal Welfare Chapter of the Australian and New Zealand College of Veterinary Scientists. Please help me welcome Dr. Natasha Lee.
Hi. A mouthful.
All right, so this is a pretty important topic. We're talking about anxiety today, and I'm glad. I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's also a blessing in disguise that anxiety is becoming less and less of a stigma these days. It's also a good thing that mental health overall is being more discussed in our culture. And there is a specific anxiety experienced by pets, which is separation anxiety. So Dr. Joel and Dr. Natasha, can you just explain what is separation anxiety and how it looks like in pets and in humans?
Okay. All right. So in the human realm, separation anxiety basically means it's anxiety that you feel when you're separated from a target figure. Typically in children, you look at it as from your parents or guardian point of view. And as you grow up, I think that target attachment figure can change over time. So sometimes it could be your spouse, sometimes it still could be your parents, it could be your best friend, or it could be your kids as well, right? And basically what happens when separation anxiety kicks in is basically when you're separated from that target attachment figure, you feel a sudden surge of anxiety, right? You feel nervous, anxious, you're not sure what's going on, and you might even get some symptoms that are akin to like panic attacks at times, right? And then when you're with that attachment figure, you feel a lot more calmer, a lot more relaxed. And you also see a very interesting change in terms of your ability to be confident, you know, have good, really good self-esteem, the ability to do stuff and be quite resilient when you're in that attachment figure, right? So a lot of times it almost feels like it's your safe harbor almost. So when you're with that person, with that in the proximity of that person, I suppose, you feel pretty good, right? No issues at all. But once you're separated from that person, that's when you get really self-conscious. You wonder whether I'm capable of doing things or not. And you find it really hard to handle the situation you're in. So by and large, that's what separation anxiety in humans look like.
Right. And it can happen to anybody of any age.
You see that a lot more in kids, right? So it's a lot more common in children, especially when they're growing up. So by the time they hit school going age, about 7, 8, 9, you see a lot of kids will, that kind of attachment to someone, that strong attachment to someone will start diminishing more often than not.
There
are going to be people who are going to grow out of it, so to speak. So they're quite okay on their own. They're quite independent. They don't really need to have the attachment figure. But every now and then you have some people who will keep that trait in that sense until adulthood and beyond.
Okay. Before I ask Dr. Natasha about how it manifests in animals, is there a differentiation between just severe attachment and separation anxiety? Because I do remember, I have a very vivid memory of my brother when he was a toddler. Mm. My mom would go out shopping for groceries and he would just cry at the door for hours.
Right. That's probably a good example of separation anxiety. So I think it's quite similar, actually, right? So I think the main difference is what happens when the target figure is not there. Some people, to be fair, there's multiple there are different ways of attaching to someone. That's insecure, an insecure attachment, which is what you described just then. When that target figure isn't there, then I freak out, I panic, I don't know what to do, and I start crying and I start wailing, right? There's also a secure attachment type, meaning that, you know, when that target figure leaves, the instant that they leave, I feel sad and I feel down, which is quite normal if you think about it, right? When someone we care about and we love leaves. But after about, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, we say, no, it's okay, they're coming back. You know, I'm very secure in myself and I'm sure that this person is going to come back, so no issues, right?
Okay.
And then there's also the ambivalent attachment kind, right? So that one, in that kind of situation, this person is very aloof, so it doesn't matter, you're here, not here, and the man doesn't matter to me, like, I don't really care. So those are the really more socially aloof, socially perhaps potentially a bit more awkward as well. So that can happen as well. So there are different types. But for today's conversation, I think specifically would be the insecure attachment type, so to speak.
We went headfirst into this, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Joel. Dr. Natasha, how does it look like in animals?
I think it's very similar to what human experience as well. The key word here is in the extreme fear and anxiety in terms of how the animal feels. And this is triggered by that separation with humans, individuals, or even sometimes objects that they have maybe a bond or they have formed a very strong attachment to. So that separation with that human or individual is the one that can trigger the extreme fear and anxiety in animals.
And this can happen if they're friends with other companion animals too, right? If they have animal friends.
Yeah, so it depends on what they form an attachment to. So they can form an attachment to humans, to other animals, whether it's, you know, dog with dog or dog with cats even. It can also be sometimes with objects like their toys or their blankets. So they have some kind of security objects. But most commonly is their attachment to humans. So that's when the human leaves the homes, that's when it actually can trigger that separation anxiety. And we hear this most commonly in dogs, but also note that cats can also experience separation anxiety as well.
What are the symptoms of separation anxiety for humans and for animals? Maybe Dr. Joel can share what it looks like in humans. Because sometimes it's like, aiya, kanchong only la. But So what are the actual symptoms? Yeah.
So if you break it down to the just like generic anxiety, what it can look like. I think it can be different for a lot of people, right? Some people experience it very internally. So it's a roiling of our thoughts, you know, it's a rumination kind of thing. So it's an incessant worry. I'm just having this multitude of stream of thoughts going to my head about things like, are they coming back? What's going to happen? Am I going to be able to survive if something happens and things like that, right? Some people experience it quite physically. So the typical flight or fight kind of symptoms you can see, right? So palpitations, for example, you start sweating, cold hands, cold feet. You get very cramped muscles after a while as well. So the more physical symptoms that you see, right? So typically that's how you would experience anxiety, a combination or some mixture of those two together at the same time. The internalized anxiety, it doesn't make for good TV because you can't see what's going on. So that's why the kind of anxiety that we get exposed to a lot is the palpitations, the breathing out of a bag, you know, freaking out, that kind of thing. Because it makes for good visuals, right? But it's experienced in so many different ways. And I think, like, similar to what you experience, when we explain to clients, like, for example, look, you're going through anxiety, that's what anxiety is, that's what you're experiencing, then they go, okay. Which is quite a relief sometimes, at least you know what's going on. Right?
Yeah, I am actually really relieved hearing this from you, Dr. Joel, so thank you. So just because it's internalized doesn't make it any less valid than a physical symptom.
If anything, it's worse, because then you don't know it's going on. No one can see it's going on. You're just going to live with it on their own, right? So it's probably going to get worse, actually.
Wow. Okay. Does that make it harder to diagnose, though, or just as easy?
It's harder to diagnose if you're alone or with family and friends. But if you come and talk to a therapist, you know, we're quite adept at digging and finding out information from you, right? So eventually we will get to the core of it, which is good.
All right. Dr. Natasha, how does it look like? Is it also the same? Can animals internalize separation anxiety?
Yes, definitely. Whatever humans experience in anxiety, we have to imagine that cats and dogs can actually experience as well. The biological process for anxiety is the same with whether it's a cat or dog or a human, because we are all mammals. We all have the same biological functioning. We have the same, central nervous system. So we have the same kind of enzymes and and lots of chemical reaction within our bodies that's going on with anxiety. Now, the difference with pets is the pets cannot come to you and say like, hey, I'm feeling anxious right now. So we need to further examine and further look at the animal in terms of how they are behaving. And their behavior is what's going to tell us whether the animal is anxious or not. Some of the things that we can start to look at in terms of behavioral indicators, whether the animal is anxious or not, is the first and foremost is a change in their normal behavior. You live with your pets, right? We live with your cats and dogs. So first of all, look at their behavior and see whether it has changed from their normal routine. So if there is some kind of change in their normal routine, it can indicate that something is going on. The other symptoms that I'm going to talk about now is going to be related to separation anxiety in general. And this can include vocalization that is excessive. This means that dogs will be barking or howling. Cats can be meowing or even crying. Sometimes I think we've seen a couple of videos online where, you know, if the owner leaves the home and the cat starts meowing in a very, very sad manner, those are all excessive vocalization. So vocalization can be one of your clue that separation anxiety is going on. Certain other behaviors include trying to escape. So you can see the dog maybe trying to paw through the door when you leave that room or when you leave the house, they'll try to escape. With cats as well, they might try. I mean, cats are smaller animals, so they're not so, you can't, paw through the door, but definitely will try. You will see them trying to find ways to get out to reach you when you leave the house. The other behavior, which is quite common, is destructive behavior. So if they can't get through the door, what else can they do? They look around and start destroying things in your house.
Oh,
so,
gosh, yeah.
Yeah, so sorry. We've heard this a lot with new pet owners where the dogs destroy the shoes, the dog destroys the couch. This all could also be signs of separation anxiety. So we need to understand what triggers this type of inappropriate behaviors at home. Even for cats as well, we can look at cats' destructive behavior. So some cats can turn around and start chewing inappropriate things in the house. Another distinct behavior that is important in cats and dogs is inappropriate elimination, which I'm specifically saying peeing and pooing inappropriate places. In the house, you might have a designated area for your dog to pee or poo, or maybe you have a routine of bringing the dog out for these natural toileting behaviors. But when their dog is anxious, they will eliminate in inappropriate places. So maybe they can dribble urine around if they are very anxious, for example. Or they can start pooing on your bed, on your couch, or in places where you don't want them to.
I wish I couldn't relate to this.
A lot of people can, isn't it?
Even
in cats as well, people think that cats are peeing and pooing on your bed is a very evil thing that cats do, but actually it can be a sign of anxiety. And the cats are doing it because, you know, that's where your smell is and they want to have that connection with
you.
Oh,
wow. My gosh. Right. Sorry, just like pieces of the puzzle just put in like live right now.
Because my mind blown.
No, because my sister, this is going to be brought up several times during this season. But yeah, I've been looking after my sister's dog. My sister has moved back to Sabah for a few years already. And she wasn't able to bring the dog with her because the airline didn't allow her to. So I'm kind of like the default caretaker alongside my brother and my mom. And whenever my sister comes by with the kids, just to make visits to KL, every time she leaves, within the week after she leaves, the dog will go up to my sister's room and pee on the bed. Mm. And my mom just, I mean, she's like, I mean, bless her. I mean, she does her best, but she gets so annoyed. And she's like, stupid dog, stupid dog. I'm like, I'm sure she does it for a reason. Like, no, she's just stupid. I don't know why she's stupid. I'm like, no. So now I get, I mean, no matter how many times, like, every time I try and tell my mom, like, I'm sure she doesn't do it to annoy you on purpose. Yeah. Mm. I try my best to get my mom to understand there must be a reason, but now I know the actual reason. And even still, if I try and tell her, I think she will still always say, like, I mean, I get her frustration a lot. Like, my mom's an old lady. The last thing she would want is to have to clean the mattress again.
So, yeah, so we all don't like to clean anyway, but...
Oh, yeah!
That gives me anxiety.
At least now we understand the behavior. I mean, sometimes they can't help it. It's not like they're doing it out of spite. It's like, oh, you leave me, I'm going to show you. But... No, but there's always a reason behind inappropriate behavior. And this is one of the things where I said behavior change is very important to understand. That if there's a change, there is something that is triggering that kind of behavior. It can be what we call redirected behavior. So they can't get to the behavior that they want to, in our case, is to follow you to wherever you go out of the house. So they redirect that behavior to something else. And us humans... we find this kind of behavior inconvenient, inappropriate. So inappropriate elimination is one of the most common things that we see, especially in cats as well. We see cats marking their territories or peeing around the house, even pooping in bad places where they shouldn't be doing. But it can be a sign of anxiety, or it can be signs of generalized stress. So something is making the animal stressful in the house and they have inappropriate elimination.
Right.
A couple of other behaviors that we need to look at, for example, pacing. So dogs and cats might pace around the house. They might circle around without any known reasons. They're just doing it round and round and round. It looks like they're trying to spend their time because they're bored. It definitely can be a sign of separation anxiety. And the last thing that I want to highlight is self-injury. This is more one of the more extreme behaviors where cats and dogs show in terms of separation anxiety. So dogs, for example, they might chew on themselves. They might start to lick themselves aggressively and start to chew themselves, and you start to see wounds appearing. In cats, this is also very common in terms of any type of stress cat. They can self-groom themselves excessively. So cats normally will self-groom themselves, but doing it excessively until you see, maybe parts of their fur will start to shed off, and it looks like the cat has been losing fur. So most of the time, a lot of times, we hear clients in vet bringing their cats to the vet clinic saying like, oh, my cat is losing a lot of fur. Look at it. And then the vet checks and it's like, no, I can't find any parasites, any fungus or any cause of the skins that's causing it to lose its fur. So one of the signs can be stress when it's grooming itself excessively. When you lick yourself excessively, you can lose a lot of fur. And in extreme cases, it can also cause wounds and lesions on the skin as well.
But it's really interesting, though, because in humans as well, right, when we have excessive levels of anxiety, self-injuring, self-harming behaviors can also be quite soothing in a way, in a warped, distorted kind of way. Because when you do injure yourself, your body automatically produces endorphins and things like that, right? And that's a really calming, euphoric kind of effect, and that's a really good balm against anxiety. But again, we're talking about really extreme cases, right? So it's actually really interesting that there's a comparison with animals as well. It's pretty fascinating.
It's a well-known animal welfare behavior indicator that its welfare is severely compromised, self-injury in animals. So we're not just talking about cats and dogs, but all sorts of animals do it as well in a lot of cases. So in cats and dogs especially, we're going to look at these type of behaviors. For dogs, it's mainly scratching and chewing excessively. And for cats, it's self-grooming excessively. So we look at these behaviors, and it will indicate that something is not right with its welfare.
Right. Dr. Natasha, now that you bring it up, I wanted to ask you, this is like all animals, right? So when you go to like a petting zoo or something, or like a zoo in general, you see an elephant or a tiger just pacing up and down. Like, it's not them getting their daily steps in, right? It's like something like animals in captivity already is kind of like, it does induce some kind of stress factor, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. So those animals, the scientific name for those kind of behaviors is called stereotypy. It indicates that the animal, has really, really bored or really nothing to do or very stressed up, that they do certain activities repeatedly, and these activities has no benefit for them. So for example, in zoos, we see a lot of animal pacing. They might pace so much that when you see the path where they pace, you know, it's quite clear, like, wow, this is the area where they walk.
It's a pattern.
A lot of times, it's a pattern.
Wow.
In certain farm animals, for example, they can't do anything. So what they'll do is they'll start chewing on the bars or on the cages.
Oh, gosh,
They might do this repeatedly. It's a form of...
It's a coping mechanism?
Yeah, like Joelle is saying, it helps them to cope by releasing endorphins and you know, giving them some kind of chemical structure in terms of what they do, because they cannot do their own behavior natural that they're actually things, motivated to do. So for example, if I'm taking a farm animal example, which is quite common, chickens, when they're laying their eggs, they want to build a nest. It's a highly motivated behavior for chickens. They will do whatever they can to build a nest before they lay an egg. But in a chicken farm where this kind of materials is not provided, the chickens is only kept in very barren cages. What else can they do? For chickens, what they'll do is they'll feather pluck. So they'll pluck their own feathers until they become almost botak. Or they can start pecking each other because that's the only thing they can do in a small little cage. There's nothing else they can do. So they'll perform this, what we call stereotypies. When we see stereotypies, it's an indicator of bad welfare.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Dr. Natasha. So sometimes, like in the instance where my mom just calls my dog, you know, like, oh, you incompetent, imbecile, you know, that kind of thing. When can you tell that behavior is misbehavior or something that should be looked into versus like how can you tell what is a symptom that is misbehavior and what is something that will point to anxiety? And like, how do you address each type of behavior?
There are several things that can cause, changes in behavior. I think the first and foremost is we want to rule out any medical causes of that kind of behavior. For example, when we talk about inappropriate elimination, there are lots of medical causes that can cause that kind of behavior. In cats, for example, lots of cats get what we call a feline lower urinary tract disease or infection. And that can cause inappropriate behavior because wherever they get a chance, they will try to pee because they can't pee, or they maybe have painful feeling when they try to pee. So when we see these kind of changes in behavior, the first thing we want to do actually is to rule out any medical condition. When we rule out the medical condition, then we'll start looking at other causes of those kind of behavior. And that's when we look at welfare. What else is triggering them? Is there any stress that's causing them to behave like such? And one of the keywords I mentioned as well is triggers. We want to look at what is the trigger that is causing this kind of behavior. Specifically in this topic, with separation anxiety, we're looking at, you know, the owners leaving the house, and that is the trigger. That separation is the trigger. But other than that, there are other things that can cause them to behave alike, like something like separation anxiety behaviors. The most important thing is to understand what is the trigger, what is their motivation for behaving that way as well. For example, maybe young dogs, maybe because they are changing their teeth, so it's very irritating to their gums, they need to chew on something. Same like babies, when they're teething, they cry a lot as well, right? So in dogs and young puppies, when they're changing, they're losing their teeth and the adult teeth is coming out, they want to chew on something. So that kind of behavior can lead to some kind of destructive behavior where they destroy the shoes or destroy your couch, destroy your favorite things. If you look at the motivation in terms of why they're behaving that way, if you can find the trigger, like, okay, this is the puppy at the time of between 4 to 6 months of age, then it could be related to that, them losing their teeth and changing their teeth instead of the separation that is triggering them.
I see. So I guess vigilance is really important for all kinds of pet ownership.
Yes, absolutely. So that's why it's important to really understand your pets. Look at what changes in their behavior, and then you start to think, like, what else have I changed lately, or what else have the animals change lately, and then you link up to see what's the cause of that behavior change.
Mm, thanks, Dr. Natasha. Oh, you provided the perfect segue for this. So what is the... Dr. Joel, it's... I think it's... Yeah, it's... It's one thing to spot symptoms of anxiety and separation anxiety, but it's another thing to try and address the root cause of it.
Yeah.
So could you share what are the things that are normally put in place for separation anxiety to develop?
As in how it develops and why it develops?
Yeah, like Okay. Root causes of separation anxiety.
So I think this is a hard question to answer, like, because I think, you know, I think a lot of what Dr. Natasha mentions is that, right, it's actually quite similar to what humans go through as well. Because like it or not, as chunky as our Zoom and our iPhones are, we're still animals at the core of it, like, right? So I think a lot of what Dr. Natasha mentioned just now is actually quite applicable to us as well, right? We also look out for things like significant changes in the ability of the function, and also to find out the whys behind it, like. I think what makes humans a bit more complicated is the fact that we have this nugget here, right? The ability to process information, to be able to think about things and concepts and ideas and all that kind of things, right? So we have to look at that idea of nurture versus nature, right? From a nature perspective, some of us are naturally born a bit more skittish, a bit more anxious, a bit more panicky kind of personalities, right?
Dr. Joel, like, I was like... Can someone just be more inclined mentally, emotionally to have to be a bit more on their nerves?
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
So,
same with animals as well. This is individual differences. Yeah.
Is that why you see in the litter of animals or puppies, and sometimes there's more energetic ones and more scared ones, right? That's probably the same thing as well, right?
Yeah, individual differences.
Hmm. So, yeah, so the nurture aspect, like, some people are naturally born that way, right? They're a bit more anxious, or a bit more calm as well. So it goes both ways, right? So a good analogy that I've seen or heard of, like, to compare the nature versus nurture thing is that, you know, nature gives you the bucket size that you have. Your nurture gives you or allows how much water you put inside a bucket, like. So people with a bigger bucket, you're calmer, means you can take on more stuff, more anxious situations, more things before you freak out, like, before you panic, like, right?
Right.
And vice versa, like, right?
I see.
So that the nurture component, that's the one that makes humans so complicated and so confusing, right? Mm. So that's when, you know, you come to things like parenting styles, for example, how your parents react towards your anxiety. You know, the classic examples of you have Asian mom, child fall down, everybody rushes there, you know, with first aid kit, you know, cushion to sit on, ice cream, you know, that kind of thing. And then you see the Amo parents, you know, keep on, okay, I'm gonna run some more, it's fine, your legs are fine, you know, just a bit of blood, it's all right. And I think those also teach us lessons, like how we react to stressful situations, how we react to anxious situations and things like that, right? And from those lessons, we take those and then we shape our lives, right? So if we have parents who have allowed us to fall down, to get up again, then naturally when we encounter situations that are more anxiety-provoking, we are a bit more resilient towards it because we know that we can adapt to it or we can do something about it. We don't have to worry about it, lah. As opposed to someone who's had everything taken care for them, right? So when they encounter something like, oh, okay, panic stations, I don't know what to do anymore.
Right. That being said, I guess it's different from letting a kid fall down and pick himself up from your from a mom saying, ah, you fall some more lah, you fall lah.
Yeah. So you cause a lot more problems with that one, definitely. Yeah, cool. So I think the nurture versus nature debate is an important one, right? Obviously, with nature, it's hard to control. You can't control for it. But if you do realize that you're naturally a bit more anxious person, right? And it's quite... I think if you're an introspective person, it's actually quite easy to realize this, right? You compare yourself with friends and family members. Everyone seems pretty calm. You're the one who's panicking about how to get to the vaccination center, for example. What happens there? What station do I go to? And all that kind of things, right? And then there you have your brother going, well, I'll just go there and see what happens. The RELA member will just point me in the right direction. I'll just walk in and see what goes on, right? If you know you're that way inclined, then the nurture part needs to take over, lah. So you need to learn things to better manage the anxiety and do things to top up your tank, lah, so to speak, lah, so that you're better able to cope in different situations, lah.
Want to know more about separation anxiety? Head to part 2 of this episode, coming up next. Thank you for listening to Jom Talk Pets by Royal Canin, where health is backed by science. Stream us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. For more pet health and nutrition tips, visit royalcanin.com/my, as well as at our socials on Facebook and Instagram at Royal Canin Malaysia.